The Art Dealer Diaries are brought to you by Medicine Man Gallery, located for over 26 years in Tucson, Arizona, specializing in antique Native American art, early Western art, including the famed Maynard Dixon, as well as modern art. You can find everything online at medicinemangallery.com. There's over 6,000 objects to select from. Also, the Charles Bloom Murder Mystery Series, written by yours truly, me, Mark Sublett. There's 6 books in the series, and they follow the protagonist Charles Bloom through all the intrigue of the art world set in Santa Fe and the Navajo Nation. These can be found on Audible, eBooks, Amazon, and of course, the gallery at medicinemangallery.com. I had a great time with John Crina of Four Winds Galleries in Pittsburgh. Learned some interesting history. This is a guy who's been in the business for 40 years, dealt with some of the greatest potters and jewelers around, started working in a mill, a steel mill in West Virginia, which is where he's from. And in that early 70s, when the jewelry craze hit everywhere, John said, forget it, I'm not going to be a mill worker anymore. I'm going to open a gallery and I'm going to start selling jewelry. So we get to find out the history and how he made his way through this world. And in the meantime, handled some of the great silversmiths and furniture makers like George Nakashima. Very interesting, and I think this is one you're going to enjoy. So I got John Crina here from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I've known John for, a long time, 30 years, I'll say. Yes. Long enough to know, but you still have black hair. I don't know how you pulled that off.
Lucky.
He says lucky. Yeah, he is lucky. And he owns Four Winds Gallery in Pittsburgh. And John is one of these guys that is a mainstay in our business. I mean, especially for any really of the high-end great contemporary art, jewelry, and Nakashima furniture, which you're going to talk about too. But what I really want to know is I don't know, because John lives in Pittsburgh and I live out in Arizona, I don't get to see him except at these shows. We talk business, we buy and sell each other art, but we never really had a chance to sit down and talk. And so I'm going to take this opportunity to do that. So, John, welcome, and tell me, where'd you grow up? Pittsburgh,
clearly. I grew up in Weirton, West Virginia, which is a steel mill town. Wow. I worked in the mills.
You did?
And I knew that wasn't going to be me, and I opened a tiny gallery in 1974. Just thought I'd give it a whirl.
So you grew up in West Virginia. West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so what did your folks do? What were they?
My dad was a son of immigrants, and he worked in the steel mill from the 8th grade on. I was supposed to go in the mill. That's how things rolled at that time. When I decided to open an art gallery, he was aghast.
Yeah. So where did he come from? Where he was an immigrant from where?
Well, the family was from Czechoslovakia. Uh-huh. His parents were from Czechoslovakia.
And so he was first generation.
First generation.
And your mom, what did she do?
She was English, Scotch, Irish, and she was mom. She was a...
And how many kids and brothers and sisters?
I'm it.
So you're an only child. Yeah. That explains a lot right now.
Yes, okay, it does. I guess.
So you graduate high school from West Virginia. But when did you first start looking at art? Do you remember painting or being involved in the arts early on?
I was exposed to art a little bit, but not really in that West Virginia.
Yeah, there's probably no art museums at all, right?
Yeah, I would go to Pittsburgh and go to the museum once in a while. But my first really interest in art was a Native American. My wife, Carol, and I started I was working in the mill, and we started taking vacations to the Southwest. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Carol still is very attractive, but she was a hottie when she was young. I started buying her Indian jewelry. Nobody had it in the East. And people went crazy.
And so what years were these that you were buying?
This is like 70 to 73.
And when did you graduate from high school?
66.
So you graduated. The Vietnam War is just starting to really kick.
Right.
And you went directly from high school to working in the mill.
Working in the mill.
And then how did you avoid the draft, or did you?
I just never, my number never came up. I was very fortunate.
You had a high pull.
Yeah.
And so it was you just lucked out. You escaped. Mm-hmm. And so you graduated again in 1966.
I went to college at Kent State University in 67 and just partied, basically.
And how long did you stay at Kent State?
1 year.
1 year?
You know, I was really
Did you have a major ever, or was it just partying?
Yeah, it was partying was the major.
And so you were there, you were gone before the shooting. And,
right.
Yeah.
And I had a partial scholarship for wrestling, and I was already having too much fun by the time wrestling season rolled around.
So you were gone.
Yeah.
And did you meet your wife there? Or no?
I met my wife. Carol was 17 when we met.
Uh-huh.
She lived in Pittsburgh, so that's how I end up in Pittsburgh.
And she's like, you're like 18 and she's 17.
No, I'm like
a little older, huh?
23 and she's 17. It was almost criminal at that time. Now it doesn't seem like a spread.
Yeah, and so you guys got married right away, and she moved back to the mills?
She moved down there, and then we...
What did she think of that?
We were in love.
Yeah, so it didn't matter.
That was okay.
And what did you do in the mills? What was your job?
I started out doing really hard jobs and dangerous jobs. At one point, I knew I wasn't going to stay, so I bid downward. I bid to lower-paying jobs where it was safe and... etc. I ended up working in a storeroom. You brought your orders in. Uh-huh. And I
what did your dad
yours.
Think when you said, I'm taking a lower paying job?
He thought I was nuts.
He hated that, right?
Yes, he hated it. And when I opened the gallery, he hates it. But then after the gallery gets going, he loved it. When he retired, he would drive up and hang out for days at a time.
Did he try to talk you out of it when you first said, I'm going to
open? Went crazy. Yeah, he went crazy. He was furious. Yeah.
And he, what did he say? What was his reasoning?
The mill, you know, this isn't going to work. 6 months, you're going to be done, and you've lost your job. And what are you going to do for healthcare? What are you going to do for dental? And I said, I'm going to floss. You know, just floss a lot.
And so you worked in the mill for how many years?
Like 6 years.
Wow, a long time, actually. Uh-huh. That's a long time. Yeah. So you're pushing.
Felt like 20.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then you moved to Pittsburgh at
that time.
Up
in the gallery.
And so you'd already been making these trips back and forth to the Southwest.
I was doing kind of Tupperware parties.
Yeah. And this is early 70s?
Yeah, early 70s.
So we're in the Indian craze, right?
Right.
Everybody
the Indian
wants
craze.
Everything.
And I would come to your house with a tackle box full of Indian jewelry. Tupperware. I'd put it out and sell what I could and give your wife a pair of earrings and everybody's happy.
So would you fly out to, say, Albuquerque?
All driving. With no money to fly. We would drive out. But I would take, you know, I could in the mill, you could get off a little extra time. So I'd go out and stay a month. I immediately went, I want to find out what quality is. Mm-hmm. I don't want to buy tourist stuff. And then I went, well, I should meet these artists too, if I'm going to be dealing with these people. So we would just drive, say, to Santo Domingo, Pueblo, show up and go, hey, we're here and we have cash and we want to buy. And I formed some great relationships with artists. And
like which artists? Was there any that you remember from Santo Domingo?
Oh, yeah. The ones that are still around. Angie Riano was one of the first people.
And what year was this? Again, early
70s. Early
70s.
Sam Lovato. There was an artist named Lorenzo Tortolita. Vidal Aragon. You knew Vidal. Mm-hmm.
Julian Lovato.
Julian. Yeah. I knew Julian. And then, you know, I branched out and started meeting Navajo artists and just the rest.
So you would take a month and you would get this material from...
Mainly from the artists. And then if I liked old... The first piece I ever bought for myself was an old pawn Zuni ring from Charles Eagleplume, which I still have.
Oh, that's right.
I would go to like the better shops and look at the old stuff and buy a piece and just... You know.
And it was kind of equivalent value-wise to the new stuff, or even less at that point?
About the same.
Yeah.
About the same, yeah.
And so, do you know why that was that you were attracted to that?
Oh, I was just drawn. Same reason I am to this day. I was just drawn
partially
to
history?
It. Huh?
Partially
the history? The history of it, the aesthetic of where you're getting something that may be made for family use or, you know, tribal use. Rather than something, and there's nothing wrong with the making for resale at all, but it just seemed to have a different feel to it.
Yeah, there was something. It had lived, maybe.
Yeah, it had lived. Someone had touched it. Someone had worn it.
Yeah,
it
my
had,
wedding ring is from, you know, 1900 Navajo ring, and it's been worn by who knows how many people. It was collected in the 30s, you know, on the reservation. And so I preferred having that because it has, you know, it has
feel,
a life.
It
yeah, there's a
something.
Life there,
yeah.
And I want to be part of that life.
Yeah.
So you were engrossed right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And how did you sell the material? Because it's easy enough to buy, but you still got to...
So we did Tupperware. We did flea markets. The earliest...
Were those back in Pittsburgh?
Back in Pittsburgh.
So we would set up a
flea. Yeah, we would do fleas and, you know. But I was obsessed and I went, I'm going to try a gallery. I went to the what would be the hippest street in Pittsburgh since the 50s. It still is to this day. It's called
Walnut Street. That's still where your place is?
Still where we are.
And you ultimately bought the building?
No, No. Yeah,
that would have been your best investment.
I paid tons of rent forever. And now I wouldn't buy the building because I'm too old.
Yeah. You know? But you've been in that space for 40 years.
I've been on the street for 44 years. I moved once in 6 years. I was there in the original spot 6 years. I've been from 1980 on in the same space I'm in now.
Yeah, so they can find you.
They find me, yeah. And we get people from all over the country coming in. And, you know, even pre-internet, we had people traveling in from New York and D.C., you know, that had heard about us.
And you'd be advertising in Native American magazine.
Yeah, American Indian Art magazine. Mm-hmm.
And so how did you come up with the name Four Winds Gallery?
Well, are we allowed to be real candid on here?
Yeah, that's all we want to say.
So Jody, that works for me to this day, his wife, my wife and I, burn one, sit on the floor, start writing down names.
So you have a little doobie and you're writing down
things. We write down names and we just keep looking through the names and we went, Four Winds, it sounds good. And I thought that it gave me flexibility. Should we not want to stay strictly Native American, Four Winds is kind of... generic enough. Yeah, it's all encompassing. You could, you know.
And you never wanted to put John Crenna's Four Winds, though it's kind of synonymous, quite frankly.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah. And that's just not me. It's just.
Yeah. You know, uh-huh. Yeah. Everybody knows who you are.
Right? Yeah.
And so you opened this. What's the date that you actually opened?
October 15th, 1974.
In 1974. Yeah. And was it primarily jewelry at that point? You hadn't gotten into Pueblo Potter?
But it was kind of lower end, the artwork. We had small pots, you know, kind of more touristy pots.
One every 2 feet.
Yeah, and we had sand paintings and, you know, some Navajo weavings, but not the kind of weavings I'm drawn to today.
And so you opened the gallery.
And it was Four Winds Trading Post originally. And then once we really started going high end, I believe it was in like the mid 80s, we changed it to Four Winds Gallery.
Was there a time frame when you kind of said, we're a different gallery? You start in 74. Was there a time, like when maybe this when you changed the name from Trading Post?
Yeah, I would say probably it took about 10 years when we started actually making money. And
yeah, I think people don't realize that. It does take 10 years, I think, in not just Native American art, but I think in any art world. And the reason I'm convinced personally it does is because people won't trust you until you've been around 10 years.
Yeah.
Because they're afraid that, A, if they give you artwork to sell or whatever, you're going to go away. Or you're going to sell something, you really don't know what you're doing, you don't have expertise, and they're afraid. And I found it took 10 years before.
Or they made a mistake.
Yeah.
I like this stuff and I bought it and look, he's gone already. Yeah. And now,
So they're very, you know, I think if people are going to open galleries, want to go in the art world, you got to expect 10 years before you really have the reputation to do it. I used three. If I couldn't make it in 3 years, I said, I'm going to go back to being a physician. And, and it took 3 years.
Yeah.
And it may have didn't.
Oh, yeah. At the beginning, it's...
I think you were fortunate in the fact you came at that time when there was huge
interest. There was
interest in Native art in the early 70s. You couldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I bet that... What did you think when you just could sell all the jewelry almost every time,
I was elated. Yeah. And we had the capacity when you're younger... If we had to work 7 days a week and we had to stay there 12 hours or whatever, it just didn't really matter. And, well, there's no money for payroll. We would go in the drawer and get some money and buy some food that last another week. And I'd say it took 3 years before you know, this is going to work. We're not going to go under.
And your dad, at what point did he go, okay, kid, you're all right? 10?
probably soon. 5 or so. Once it started being successful, and a big turning point for my dad, I had a real good friend that was an attorney, and we were having a big opening, and he's talking to my parents, and, you should be really proud of your son. This gallery is so beautiful. And my dad says, yeah, but we always hoped he would become a doctor or a lawyer. And my friend said, are you kidding? I would trade places with him in a heartbeat, you know.
And he had to see it from a different viewpoint.
From a different viewpoint, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For him, success was a higher degree.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I had the same similar experience, my parents. So, you know, I'm a doctor and I'd say I'm going to open an art gallery.
Yeah.
They're like, well, don't get rid of your license, kid.
Yeah, yeah.
It may or may not work out, but give it a shot, go for it.
Yeah.
And so your gallery progresses. You're probably at this point maybe the only gallery of that type or one of the few on the East Coast, right?
Yeah, and I would say, not to step on anybody's toes, but pretty much there aren't too many galleries in the Eastern United States that do real high-end at this time.
Yeah. Ever, really, to
ever.
Some extent,
yeah,
right?
Ever.
I mean,
you know,
there's very few.
And
that...
you would think New York, and you would think D.C.
There's some good
private dealers. Right. And well, I would say this, too, like John Malloy does a great job. I think we're unique in that we carry historic material and contemporary material, and we specialize in jewelry, but we also specialize in ceramics. We're kind of more inclusive.
Right. And one of the things you've done, and I applaud you, and I follow that same line to some extent, is that you have lots of historic material, but you also have lots of artists that you represent and show their work. And who are the longest jewelry silversmiths that you've had that you continue to show their work?
Well, some of them have passed away. Like Julian Lovato, I start with at the beginning.
Yeah,
Vidal Aragon, I start with at the beginning. The longest now was probably Mike Bird Romero. Mike Bird, I knew Mike Bird before he made jewelry. His late wife Allison worked for Ray Dewey. And I met Allison at Ray Dewey's, and Carol and I would go out with Mike and Allison. He was an appliance salesman at Sears.
Wow.
And he loses his job at Sears and starts tinkering with jewelry, and I started buying it right away.
You could just see that there was something
yeah.
there.
And I go way back with Marquis Platero, pretty much to the beginning of his career.
How about Lolima?
Oh, Lolima?
Yeah.
I do more Lolima now than I did when he was alive, mainly because I couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
I would go to his house and I could buy
a ring.
We would go, Carol and I would go up there and we would buy a piece because that's...
And what was he like? What was Charles Lolima like?
Oh, he was exuberant. He was a big flirt. He was brilliant. He did his own PR also. Bigger than life.
Yeah, I was going to say, you knew you were with a superstar when you were in his house.
Yeah.
And
he had the talent to back it up.
Like he did, right?
Anybody can have that presentation, but he really had the talent to back it up. He was really a special,
and his
unique
work
person.
Was super expensive, even in the 70s
and
80s.
For me. Like, I would go in there, and we'd be there 3 hours talking to him and walk out with a piece, and it would break the bank, you know?
And could you sell it fairly quickly?
No.
Because it's high-end, right?
Because it's high-end.
And you have to develop that market,
so,
and it
so
takes
at,
a while.
Just say, at that time, if you came in my store and wanted to buy a buckle, I could give you a nice buckle for $300 or $400, and my Lolima buckle was at that time $1,500 or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I had similar experience with Richard Chavez. I loved his material.
Yeah.
I would buy it, but I was hard finding the clients because I just hadn't developed those clients.
Yeah. And I've been with Richard forever, too.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's great.
And his son is amazing.
Yeah, Jared does great work.
He's amazing as well. So you've developed these clients, these artists that are your friends now.
I'm really friends with so many. Like, I come out here and it's so good to see everybody. A lot of them still come back and do shows. And
that's got to be fun for them too, because they're getting exposed to a whole different
market. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I treat people well when they do a show. You know, we don't just do the work.
Yeah.
You know? If it's baseball, I take them to the Pirate game and we eat in the best restaurants. And we go, I live out in a rural area. And if they hike, we go on big hikes.
And so... Not only doing jewelry, but I know you've had a fascination, especially for Margaret Tafoya's pots. And you did a book, right? That was
We did a book, and it was a museum show. We had about 80 Margarets.
Yeah, tell us about that.
So probably in 75, Carol and I decide we want to get a really good piece of pottery. And we buy a Margaret Tafoya storage jar, well, like a long neck jar. We buy it from Spivey.
Richard, yeah.
I think it was $2,000, so I give him $200 a month, and he lets me buy it.
And was Richard in Santa Fe at that time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Then we get that one paid off and we buy another. And we're just buying them for ourselves. So then as soon as we get on that, we go, we got to meet Margaret. So we start visiting Margaret and she's magic. She's just a special person.
She's about 4'11" at the best. Uh-huh. Doesn't speak a lot of English.
Yeah. And first when I meet her, I was boy. And then I was, you know, we go there a few times. And then I was the boy from Pittsburgh. And then I was John, and then as she gets more elderly, I become the boy from Pittsburgh, and at the end, I'm boy again.
And were you able to buy some pots from her?
I bought
her?
A lot from Margaret, and you know, I became friends with like her daughter, Toni Roller, got to know different family members. I didn't know I was putting a collection together until I probably had 15 or 20 of them, and I sold one, and I went, oh man, I can't believe I sold that. Why did I sell that? And then I went, I'm collecting.
Did you ever try to go back and get it?
I ended up getting it back.
Isn't that funny how that is? I did the same with the Maynard Dixon painting. I sold it and had to because I needed the money early on, 25 years ago. And 3 or 4 years later, I went and paid the guy double and got it back.
So it becomes a total passion. So I don't know what year it was, 7 or 8 years ago, we have 80 Margarets. The Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, which is a beautiful and prestigious museum, approaches me to do a show. So we do that show, and it was fantastic. They put in one of the major galleries. My friend and colleague Charles King does the catalog. He, for me, is the most expert person in contemporary pottery.
And Charles is going to be on tomorrow.
Oh, great.
And so tell me what the name of
nice shoes on.
Yeah, of course he does. I love his shoes. Oh, that's right. I'm going to have to wear some
Born of Fire.
Really good shoes tomorrow. I'm going to blow him away. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah. Born of Fire, right?
Yeah. So it opens at the Carnegie, and they do all 80 pots. It's phenomenal. We blow up all these photos, and Nathan Youngblood came in, and Toni Roller came in, and I believe Linda Tafoya came in. Several family members. So we leave that run. When it's over, a great small museum in the East, which is called the Erie Art Museum, does the show. It goes there. From there, it moved to the Arizona State University Ceramic Center, which is one of the top ceramic collections in the world, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's not specifically native. So three of the four are not native venues, which I think is great. You're showing it as fine art.
Yeah, it is fine art.
Yeah. And then it goes to Millicent Rogers. And after that, I went, okay, that's enough.
You also had an exhibit of it
here at
in Santa Fe at the El Museo at the show that we're doing. And that's why John and I are here, actually. Yeah. John is doing a show along with Mira Nakashimi. John has been collecting Nakashimi furniture and selling it. I collect it as well. I don't sell it. I just like to collect it. It's very organic, and I just think it goes beautifully. So tell us about that, because I think that's a really interesting connection. And you started doing that in 1980. You got your first piece, right?
Got my first piece in 1980. I'm reading the Sunday paper. That's things that they used to have. They were print.
And, I vaguely remember print.
All of us dealers do the one ads. You're looking for, you're haunting the one ads, looking for that native piece. And there was an ad, George Nakashima, dining table and chairs. And I knew what his work was. I was a little familiar, but had never really been exposed to it. I decide to go look at it. I buy a dining table and six chairs for $5,000, which at the time,
a lot of money in 1980.
Oh man, I'm choking. I can't believe I did this. It's now, 30 some years later, and three dining room tables later, and my house is filled with Nakashima.
It's easy to live with, isn't it?
Oh, it's great to live with. And it's so complimentary with the native art. You put a Pueblo pot on a piece of Nakashima furniture, it's going on. It's
and he
beautiful.
Was, so he's, for those who might not know who he was a great modernist furniture maker who was interned actually in Idaho at one of the internment camps back during World War II. And he would actually he was building the huts that people were living in. And it was quite clear that he had a talent for this. In fact, again, trained at MIT, if you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And he ends up getting a piece of property, I think it was offered to him for free, at New Hope, Pennsylvania, right? Which is where you are. So he moves out there, and so there must be, I mean, that must be one of the best places for that type of furniture anywhere, right?
They say that the most Nakashima furniture would be in, that's in the Philadelphia area. So obviously that's the most. New York second, Pittsburgh third. One of the main reasons there's so much in Pittsburgh was one man, his name was Paul Plannert, and he was the go-to designer. Commercial, residential, the universities. He was great friends with George. So if you hired Paul Plannert, which is who everyone hired, part of the deal was you took a ride up to New Hope and you bought some Nakashima furniture. So which has been really great for me. I've managed to find a lot of pieces.
I would think, yeah.
Several of the pieces, in fact, in this exhibition just came out of a home in Pittsburgh. They were purchased right from George. They've never been on the market. And there's something special about that when you're the...
And in this show that you provided a lot of the furniture, George Nakashima furniture, Mira, who is the daughter, who is also extremely talented craftsman, is going to be here as well. And she's brought her furniture and her stuff is great too.
I can't say enough about Mira. She grew up at her father's side. She has the absolute gift that he had. Mm-hmm. There's no difference in quality or design or anything. The difference is time. You know, his is made when his was made, and she has carried this legacy on. And
one of her pieces just broke a world's record, right?
Yeah,
I think
70,000
or something.
A dining table broke, with the chairs, it was, I think, 115,000.
Yeah, that was a lot. I know, it was just crazy, but great.
Yeah, she's going to achieve exactly as much recognition as her father did. And she respects him, she respects his philosophies, his legacy. She's doing a lecture, I believe, next Sunday.
Yes,
if you can make it to that lecture, she is an incredible
speaker. Yeah, we will
advertise
that out on our forums. And so, you met George?
No, I never met George. No, never met George.
But you probably feel like you know him.
I feel like I know him,
right?
I've known Mira probably at least 20 plus years, and we became such close friends. When I go visit, we stay in Mira's guest house, which is totally designed and built by George. Everything's built in.
I've seen a documentary of that, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's all, everything in it is his.
Everything in it's George. Everything built in. The bed's George, and you're sleeping in this cool little place.
That has to be an interesting feeling.
Yeah, it's magic.
You know, to have that history, and you just know he was there, and all his tools are there, and she's following in his footsteps.
And Mira's husband, John, works the chair shop, and he worked for George also, and then he spends the rest of his life with Mira, and he's a pretty amazing fella too, and he'll be here.
Oh, that's
also
fantastic. So you've got, and what other areas that we might not know you for that you do? Because you do paintings too. I know you like Fritz Schulder.
I like Fritz Schulder. I do Curtis photography.
Did you ever know? I knew Fritz, and he used to come into my gallery to see Dixon, Maynard Dixon. He was an interesting guy.
Fritz. I didn't really know him well. In the heyday, who I represented was R.C. Gorman, who was, what a character.
Yeah, that guy was.
Man, I represented him throughout his heyday, and when he came and did a show, people would, it's the only artist I've ever had where people lined up down the block to just get a chance to buy a piece.
I lined up in one of those lines once.
To get a poster.
basically. Uh-huh. Yeah, I just wanted to meet him, and that was at the Capistrano Gallery.
Yeah, Sue DiMaio.
Sue DiMaio's gallery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the line was literally out the door, up the stairways, and through. And it was just like, oh, my gosh. And that would have been like probably 88 maybe.
Yeah. And I bought Sue DiMaio's entire collection before she passed away.
Yeah.
After she retired, as she moved to Santa Fe from California, I continued to do business with her. Then she relocated to Texas outside of Austin. And we still continued to keep up and do a little business. And then about a year before she passed away, she called me and she said, if you're interested, I'd like to sell you my collection.
Yeah.
I'm on the next plane.
Yeah, I bet you are.
I get out there, and you knew Sue. She was, you know how she was. And she goes, you know why I'm dealing with you? And I said, I don't know. We're friends. We got along. She goes, yeah, and you're the only one who doesn't think I'm old, doesn't think I'm stupid just because I'm old. And I actually had to get a moving van and move. It was paintings, sculptures.
Yeah, she had a great place.
Oh, and then, and I think all I'm going to buy is paintings and sculptures. And she says, well, you ready to look at jewelry? I'm like, sure. I'm expecting, you know, 10 pieces. Because she was friends with Loma. We go in the dining room. There's a sheet over the table. She pulls the sheet off. There must be 400 pieces of jewelry, including a lot of pieces from the C.G. Wallace auction.
That was a famous auction in '70s.
Right, yep. Yeah. Great Zuni material. And clear down to like the lowest end earring she had left over from her shop. And she goes, you have to buy it all. So I did.
And it probably didn't take long for it to find new homes.
Yeah,
either.
Yeah.
That was a great click. Great. Mm-hmm. That was a great place to go visit. I was in L.A. Mm-hmm. And in Tustin and working as a physician. I was in the military. Mm-hmm. So I was stationed there for 4 years with the Marines, and working as a naval physician with the Marines. And I would go when I could to Sue's place and mm-hmm. shop and mm-hmm. Indian Territory and shop. And mm-hmm. you know, I was still collecting. I was buying and selling just a little bit, but you know, to see all that material. And then, of course, mm-hmm. you end up with it 20 years later. Yeah.
Oh, and one more Sue story. So my wife is a cancer survivor, but for a time, we weren't sure she was going to make it. And I'm visiting Sue. This is in Texas. And she goes, I always liked Carol so much. And she gets a Teddy Wiatki Zuni fetish ring that was made in about the 1930s. And she mm-hmm. said, I'm going to give her this. And she's going to keep this ring, and she's going to be just fine. And that all turned out.
Oh,
to
wow.
be true, but man, that
isn't that wonderful?
Stung my heart. Yeah,
yeah,
stung
I bet.
My heart.
Right, mm-hmm. A very valuable ring.
Yeah,
but value came out. It wasn't the value of the price. It
right.
was the value of the emotion.
Right, right.
And the generosity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's. I mean, we find those.
Once
people.
She had lost her daughter to cancer. Remember
yeah.
Tori?
Yeah, that's yeah. right. Yeah. So, who else was monumental in your mentorship as you grew up? Was some of their old dealers that you remember?
Ray Dewey. I did a lot with Ray Dewey.
I don't know if Ray would like to be called old, but...
Well, he's not old, but yeah. Ray Dewey yeah, helped Ray me out a lot. I learned a lot from just watching his kind of his business model.
Yeah, he always ran a very good business, I think, in Santa Fe.
And his windows, you remember when he had...
I do.
Yeah.
That was right on the plaza.
On the plaza, Ray would plan his Indian Market Week window a year in advance and get material to do these cohesive, incredible windows.
Right.
I learned a lot from, well, I do a lot with ceramics, so I would say Spivey. Yeah. Rick Dillingham was a huge influence.
Yeah, tell us to me about a little bit about Rick. I only met him a few times. I didn't know him. Like Richard, I knew very, very well, extremely well. But Rick Dillingham, who wrote Seven and then the 14 Families, and was his own... One of a fine potter in his own right. What was
great
he like?
Great contemporary potter.
Yeah.
He was bigger than life.
He was
brilliant. He was brilliant intellectually. He and Spivey brought back Pueblo pottery to where it is today. I think almost single-handedly. The best potters had a hard time getting any money for their work, and they were basically working hard, giving it away. They weren't making a living.
Yep.
Spivey and Dillingham would buy everything these potters produced, put the price on it, give the potter a fair amount of money that allowed them to live and keep going. And they would, you know, if you wanted a piece of that pottery, you paid the price or you walked, you know, and they just...
And they wrote literature.
They wrote literature. They both were, they were scholarly.
Richard wrote the Maria book, mm-hmm. and he also helped with Charles King on the Tony Day book.
Tony Day, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Dillingham wrote Seven Families and then 14 Families.
And then Acoma, he wrote an Acoma
book.
Yes,
he did.
And his pottery was incredible.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of his pots were... kind of influenced by the old Anasazi pots where Dillingham would make a pot, paint it, break it, and put it back together, and then fire it. So it came out real, real.
And his pots are quite valuable, actually.
Quite valuable.
And you'll see them in a lot of museums. Did
American
you ever
ceramic.
Deal in his pottery?
I've owned pieces. I never dealt in it, but I've bought pieces from him. And we used to trade. We'd do some horse trading. Not that you would know anything about that.
No, I don't. Yeah, no. In fact, I think
we just did a trade right now.
Doing a trade about an hour ago.
Can you tell them what it is?
Oh, sure. We're going to do a Nakashimi table for me, and he's going to get a Maynard Dixon for him. We're going to work out something that we both win, and we both come away with something that we treasure.
Everybody's smiling, and the art is so much more valuable than money.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, if you're in this, if you love it.
Yeah. You're not doing it because you want to really have the pieces and live with the pieces, then, you know, as a dealer, there's lots that just sell it, and that's fine, and that's their business, and they do it. But I think sometimes if it gets a little deeper and more emotional for you, to me, that's more special. And, you know, I could have done a lot of things. I could still be, you know, practicing certification, that kind of stuff. But this is so much more
fun. And
you could,
if it was about only the money, you could sell the things you collect.
Yeah, that's right.
Then you have more money, but then you don't have that sting in your soul. Like, you've had this. I'm certain people come to your home or whatever. Well, I really want to buy that, but it's not for sale. But how much do you want?
Right.
And you go, you're not hearing me.
I vet these people so they don't.
Yeah, but every once in a while.
I tell them. I actually do. I vet people and say, listen, nothing's for sale. This is my private stuff. It may seem like it is, but it isn't. This is what I live with. I love it. And it's, you know, you're talking about things that have meaning to me, not just a monetary meaning. Yeah. And so enjoy, and but don't ask me how much it is.
Yeah. And we're only curators of this stuff anyhow.
That's right.
Because it's, after we're gone, it goes on, and hopefully.
Ask my kids. Yeah. They'll be able to tell you what the value is. Because they may, whether they have the same feeling for it or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And how have you seen the business change? So, you know, you've been in it as long as anyone. You still have an active gallery in Pittsburgh. What do you see changes on? I mean, clearly price structure has changed in certain things. But how is your business?
I feel, everybody had a rough few years, but the entire economy of the United States.
2008, 2009.
Yeah, everybody hurt. Right now, I feel really strong. I have good younger employees who are internet savvy. I think we have a really great website. We're getting younger buyers. It seemed like for a while you couldn't get a younger buyer. You know, it was kind of people my age. Now we're seeing a lot more young people become interested.
And a lot of that, would you say, is jewelry? Because that's kind of the thing we see that people do.
A lot of it's jewelry, but then you kind of, you get them in there and they're buying jewelry and you start talking about the art. And I don't expect a young person to buy some, you know, for shoulder painting or something, but I try to carry things by younger artists, and
So you're seeing people
interest.
Start to
I'm
have
seeing interest.
And do you have kids too that are going to?
I have one son. He has no interest.
Yeah. So.
And that's that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it'll probably when you go, the gallery will go maybe.
No, I'm hoping not. What I really see is. A couple of my employees now seem really passionate about it, and I would try to come up with a way to
keep it going.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful.
And again, if you're going, and not to be cavalier, but if it's not all about money, there are ways that you can do that.
That's right. So it keeps going on.
Yeah. I would hate to see it close.
Yeah. Well, it shouldn't. I mean, it's been, again, a mainstay for 40 years.
Yeah.
I'm going on 30, which is hard to imagine. Doesn't seem that's possible. Retirement, my future. But I'm having a lot of fun doing these podcasts, I must admit.
Yeah. I actually entertained, someone approached me and wanted to buy the gallery, and I'm going, wow, I'm 70 years old, da da da. The closer I got to actually
going forward,
I called the person and I told her, I said, you know what? She says, I've been expecting this call. She said, you can't do this.
No, I mean, I think most of the people that I've met in my career who do this, they don't retire. They just keep going until they can't do it anymore, and physically there becomes a time.
Yeah.
You and I are clearly not at that point. You just flew in today and you were willing to come do this on the spur of the moment, which tells me you're still excited about talking about art and just getting the word out of who we are and what we do. So tell me what else. What's the future for John Crenna?
Keep doing this as long as I can.
You have any cool shows coming up besides the Nakashima show?
My next show is Jennifer Curtis, who's a Navajo, really good Navajo silversmith. She's the daughter of Thomas Curtis, who passed away maybe 3 or 4 years. It might even be more. It might be 5 years ago. Thomas was one of the best Navajo Smiths of our time, and he was a really good friend. I met him in the 70s, and you know, we had a long, great relationship, and now his daughter's carrying, she has his tools, she learned from him.
Nice.
And she's really...
So you're going second generation
second
now.
Second generation, huh? Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's when we know we're
well,
getting
like
old.
You said, Jared Chavez.
Yeah,
you know.
No, Jared's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I knew him when he was not mm-hmm. Jared, actually.
Sippy, so that's third generation. I knew Joe Quintana. Huh. I used to go visit Joe.
Yeah, what was he like? He's a fantastic
silversmith.
Oh, I love
Joe. I love Joe. He was a real character. He, what I always remember, he had Dachshund dogs, and he was like one of those people that doted on his dogs. So you'd go in, and the dogs would have little turquoise collars on.
Joe
he made
Quintana,
him little jewelry,
right?
Joe Quintana. And then I carried Sippy's, his son. And now Sippy's son, Wadi, Joe's grandson, is doing really nice contemporary work, and I'm representing him.
Yeah, they're wonderful silversmiths from mm-hmm. Coach D. Yeah, I get yeah. the material periodically, especially Joe. I love mm-hmm. his stuff when you can yeah. find it. But again, yeah. it's hard to find now as well.
Mm-hmm.
And have you found that the jewelry market is still strong? I mean,
it's
it is
really
for me,
strong.
Right?
Yeah. It's really strong. Yeah. yeah, that's the strongest of what we do.
I agree. I think yeah. so too. Well, and we covered some ground.
We did. We
yeah,
did.
Right. So we're going to go finish a trade up, right?
Let's go
see
do
if
it.
We can.
Let's go
you,
do
see
it.
See if
yeah.
you can pick out the right thing
that's
that
right.
you want. I already picked out what you
okay.
want. What I want to take
okay.
home with me.
I want that big oil painting, so that's even. I like that.
Well, we can talk, but that's, I think, about four of your pieces. You may not want to do that trade
yeah,
right
yeah.
off the bat. So John, and I have always said Krena, but it's really Krena.
Mm-hmm.
4-1's Gallery was here today. He was kind enough to come and speak, and thank you. It's
all right.
Yeah, it's nice knowing you, John.
Yeah, nice knowing you.
A lot of years.
And we always, speaking of going on, we always see each other at the gym every year.
We do. Yeah. In fact, I'm going
you
to work out
hardcore,
tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't ever miss a day.
Yeah.
And
uh-huh.
that's why we'll make it to 80.
That's right.
Knock on wood.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Mark.
This is another Art Dealer Dives with John
okay.
Krena. Thank you.
Thank you.